Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus. We stream live at kuci.org, and eventually, actually not too far in the future, probably a few days, we will podcast this show on iTunes. Look for Writers on Writing, subscribe if you will, and whenever this show is podcast, it will be in your podcast file on iTunes. It's December 19th, Wednesday, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And my guest today is Janet Fitch. She'll be with us for the entire hour. And she will also be with me in person on January 15th, 2019 at the Lido Village Bookstore in Newport Beach. You can find more about that at penonfire.com. In any case, Janet Fitch is the best-selling author of White Oleander, which was an Oprah's Book Club pick, and it was translated in 28 languages, and it was a feature film. Paint It Black, widely translated and recently made into a film directed by Ambler Tamblyn. And she's here today to talk about The Revolution of Marina M, which is an epic novel of a young woman's coming of age during the Russian Revolution. Her short fiction and essays have been published in anthologies and journals such as Black Clock, Black Warrior Review, Los Angeles Noir, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and Real Simple. And her popular Writing Wednesday writing tip videos can be found on her author Facebook page, and they are great. So informative, and Janet is so generous with information. So check out her website also, Janet Fitch Writes. After you listen to this show, or maybe you've already read the book and you have discovered her website, and there is just a plethora of information, links to articles, links to interviews with her, video and print, and there's just so much info there. Let's bring her on. Hey, Janet.
Hi, Barbara.
Hello. So, well, I'm on page 511, and I will be finished by the time you come to Newport on January 15th, if not way before. But I want to talk about The Revolution of Marina M, and it's such a story about people and character, and it's also such a deep history of the Russian Revolution. For those who don't know, talk about why it was important for you to write about Russia.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I have, you know, people know me as an L.A. writer. And yes. My first two books, definitely, you know, very much L.A. But I'm a writer of place. Place is very important to me. And I have a hidden connection, or not so hidden if you know me, connection with Russia through Russian literature, through... back in the olden days when girls got books like Cherry Ames, student nurse in school, I was always a tremendous reader, and my family, both my parents, we'd often sit at dinner and everybody would have a book out. they had given me some horrible book in junior high. I came home just fuming, and my father took a book off his shelf, and he had said, "Have you read this?" And he put this book in my hands. I was like, you know, seventh grade, eighth grade, and it was Crime and Punishment. Mm. And it was like, wow, that was what I was looking for. You know, something happened. you know, there's murder and guilt and recrimination and, you know, high drama. And, you know, I have such a taste for that. So he was the right book in the right hands at the right time. And and just totally got me hooked on Russian literature.
And then you were a student there in, what, 1977?
Yeah, I studied Russian in high school and in college, and I thought I was going to become an historian. I was on a student exchange to England in the Russian Studies Department, and their students go to Russia to study. And so I kind of slipped in with them. And so I was in Leningrad in 77, just soaking it up.
So your research as well was so monumental. I mean, you know, going through your website, all the books you cite, all the stuff you did, I swear. I mean, talk about writing and researching and how you do it. I mean, my thought is that it's all happening at once and that you're not spending years researching and then writing. Talk about your process.
That's right. That's right. Research, because I had originally intended to become an historian, I learned something that historians know. It's a disease that's kind of fatal for historians other people probably in the social sciences, but especially history, is we're prone to something called research rapture. Hmm. Which means you know anybody who sits down to research, you know, how to make an eclair at 6 o'clock at night and ends up in Madagascar reading about lemurs, understands what research rapture is. It's so neat, and you find something really neat, and it carries you somewhere else, and then that carries you somewhere else, and. But when you're writing a novel, you could be 6 months down the road, a year down the road, and have gone completely in some crazy direction that, you know, you end up, it's like following rabbits or something. And then you have to tear it all out. So you have to be, you know, very careful about getting too far from what is coming up from inside you. So I research and write at the same time. So I research what's under my hands. Once I have the big sweep, once I, you know, have a sense of the big picture, which I do because I've taken so much Russian history, that I can, I just research what I need for the scene, for the chapter, for the section of the book, and not let myself follow, you know, just follow wildly every cool thing that happens.
So how did wanting to be a historian segue to becoming a writer?
Well, you use the same skills. You know, I was discouraged from writing at kind of an early age. I had a teacher who didn't like me, and I sent her a story. I was hoping she would see that there was something to like about me. And what she did was she took a red marker and gave it a good going over and gave it back to me. And I didn't write again till I was 21, the year that I went to Russia. It just wasn't safe, but that impulse will out. And writing history is very much like writing fiction, except that everything has to be researched and footnoted and, you know, absolutely scrupulously true. But it's about building a character, bringing a reader into a world, making them understand, making them feel what it is to be in that world and making those decisions. And it's a huge screen, you know, it's a huge canvas and characters, incredible characters, and using language to build a world for readers. So the skills are very much the same. So when I decided to become a fiction writer that year that I went to Russia, when I was living in England, I decided I was going to become a fiction writer. But the tools are pretty similar.
So do you remember the moment you knew you had to write this particular book? Was there any kind of epiphany or telling moment or something that happened where you said, you know, This has to happen.
No, it's a gradual bubbling up. Here in LA, we have the La Brea tar pits, mm-hmm. you know, so it has these slow bubbles that work their way up through the tar. It was more like that. You know, it was always going to happen because I just am so obsessed with Russia. And I had written a short story about a Russian emigre living in L.A., working as a hotel maid, that was published, a short story that was published in Black Clock. And I started to, you know, develop that as a book. And every time I did the backstory. That's what people were interested in. And then I realized, oh, my God, I am going to write a book about the Russian Revolution.
Interesting.
And that was very scary. And I decided that I should write it in verse.
In verse.
So I started this book as a novel in verse because it's a brushstroke. You know, mm-hmm. you don't have to spend pages and pages, you know, creating a world. You just, you know, it's just a light calligraphy. So I thought it was not going to be as, you know, enormous a task as it turned out to be.
I'd love to hear you read.
Okay.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Janet Fitch. Her new book is The Revolution of Marina M. Okay.
Okay, well, I start the book in Carmel, California, in 1932. For me, it's really important to know the voice of to understand the voice of the novel, where that voice is, where it is. You know, I tell you, I'm a person of place. So here is Marina, 1932, so she's 32, New Year's Eve, Carmel.
Okay.
Rocking on the razor-muscled bay, lulled by the sleepy toll of buoy bells, the music of rigging, the eloquent stanzas of the waves, I wait for news from the sea. No boys or girls play on the deserted beach now, only a few stoic fishermen huddled on upturned buckets. The slow labor of the poet building himself a stone house at the cove's south end makes for mild entertainment. If I knew him better, I'd tell him the danger of trusting to solid things. It's an illusion. All one needs is a rented cabin, a decent stove, a small boat, a garden gone to seed for winter. I watch the lanky form of my landlord's son crossing the shingle, coat collar up, stopping by to collect rents. I have the money in a cigar box back in my cabin, most of it anyway. It's only $5. The shack's not built for winter. I don't complain. There are shutters to block out a storm and an iron stove with a solid pipe. In a few minutes, I will beach my boat on the pebbly shore and give him his due. We'll share a bottle of home brew, or perhaps it comes with a flask. No liquor on the premises just now, though it will come soon down from San Francisco. Those who love poetry, even my unreadable foreign brand, are a tender breed. Why don't you write in English, Marina? Asked my friend Elizabeth. You speak it so well. My dilemma. My English is good enough for the little stories I publish in pulp magazines, but for poetry, one needs one's native tongue. The voice of the soul is not so easily translated. Though to say soul here is already wrong, we say dusha, meaning not just the spiritual entity, but also the person himself. A tug on the line, I pull in a shining perch, shockingly alive. I add it to a rockfish in my pail and row back to shore. At times like this, I surprise myself how I've managed to create something of a life on this foggy shore, out of the broken pieces of myself, scavenged from the sea like flotsam. Or is it jetsam? It irks me not to know the difference. I will have to consult my oracle, the giant moldy Websters I've acquired since my arrival here, the very edition we had in my childhood home that lived on a stout shelf, along with the Nouveau Larousse Illustré, the Deutsches Wörterbuch, and Dahl's Explanatory Dictionary of the Living Great Russian Language. When I was very small, I had to sit on my knees to read these great books. Why do you not write in English, Marina? Because when you are flotsam or jetsam, you cling to what is yours. After the landlord's lanky son leaves, I lay my Websters on the scrubbed table in the lantern light to learn that flotsam is the debris left from shipwreck, while jetsam is merchandise thrown overboard from a ship in crisis to lighten the load. Ship in crisis, that it was. The difference seems to be tied to the fate of the ship. Did it survive after shedding those such as myself, tossing this overboard, jetsam, to lighten the load? Or did it founder to be torn apart, mastless and rudderless, the planks and boards washed ashore, flotsam, perhaps one bearing the ship's name, and the name was Revolution.
Thank you so much. That was Janet Fitch reading from The Revolution of Marina M. I want to ask you about writing in verse and why you did that and why Marina is a poet. But what I also want to say is, and I remember this from when you came on the show before talking about White Oleander or, and then again, Paint It Black, but you are willing to go down roads with your writing. And if your chapters and chapters into a project, or you've written a whole draft and it's not working, you're willing to throw it out and start again. And I think that is so interesting because there's such impatience amongst writers in terms of you want to write it, you want to get it out there. And talk a little bit about that, about I don't know, is it trusting yourself? Is it simply persevering, believing in a vision? What is it that just makes you carry on?
For me, it's very physical. You know, I don't feel well if it's not right. I mean, I can feel it in my stomach. I feel, you know, vaguely queasy if it's not right. So there's almost a visceral need to get it right. Once I get it right, that really lifts. And I just crawl ahead on my stomach, and I can feel when it's not right. And it just, it can't stay that way. It just, it has to be right. It has to make me feel like, yes, that I got that. I pinned that. So, yeah, I've thrown out a book. I had a book that failed between White Oleander and Paint It Black. And, you know, if it just isn't working, it's so obvious. You know, it's a physical sensation to me. And what else could I do but throw it out?
But that was your opinion, though, right? I mean, I think, didn't you say your publisher was willing to publish it, but you said no?
Absolutely. It is always the writer who decides. And, you know, if the writer has no sense of taste, they're never going to write anything, you know, that will stand. You know, I'm batting, you know, I'm not just trying to write for this season. Mm-hmm. You know, it's too much work. It's too much part of, you know, it's too much of my life. It is my life. You know, I'm not going to spend my life on something that's going to last a season. I'm always looking for something that's, you know, going to stand on a shelf and be speak to people in 50 years, in 100 years. Well, maybe, you know, maybe it won't. You know, life is ephemeral, things happen, but I'm always trying for that.
You've said something, maybe in an interview I read or heard, you've said something to the effect of that you get the idea in your head, but you write from the body. Is that accurate?
Something like that? Well, in that sense, yes. You know, I always call it head up and head down writing. You know, neck up writing. Neck up writing is saying, ooh, I'm going to write about this middle-aged widow, and then she's going to meet this, you know, some guy, and it's going to be like this, and it's going to be like that. I have an idea. You know, that's, our culture seems to tend to these high concept works. But it's so divorced from who you are, these ideas, they're constructs. And I just can't write that way. You know, I think that Annie Dillard said that the writer or the artist is the bearer of the paint box, of its inherited contents of obsessions and fascinations, which means we are our paint box. We already have our obsessions and our compulsions and our history and our taste and our colors within us. And if you forget about these ideas, these, you know, neck up concepts, but you work down into who you are, into the paint box of who you are, and let that come up and write from that, then there's no limit to how deep that goes, and then the work will really move other people, which is what I want.
Mm. So, talk about why Marina. You made Marina a poet, and when you were beginning writing the book in verse, you said a few words about that. But talk about how the two are connected: writing in verse, and then her becoming a poet.
Well, her time, the time of the Russian Revolution, was a great age of poetry in Russia. Russian literature swings between the great eras of prose and the great eras of poetry. And from the turn of the century through the revolution was the silver age of Russian poetry, the golden age being Pushkin's time. Pushkin came and went, and then you have the great age of prose writing, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Turgenev and all that. And then the prose starts flattening out and the poetry starts picking up. And this was the great age of poetry. So in those days, young people, instead of wanting to be basketball players or music stars, they the poets were the superstars. Mm. And my character is in love with Anna Akhmatova, who was very tall and stately and beautiful, and you know, these wonderful lovers and this beautiful poetry that has been those poets who wrote at that time, and that's never been equaled in my mind. So she, you know, the fact that she's a poet does not surprise me. There were a lot of girls who were poets in those days, and boys. I mean, everybody idolized these people. But the experiences that she goes through in the book really create her as the poet that she is going to be. And I believe, you know, also that the poets hold the standard of language. You know, fiction writers can win it on the drama, the scenes, the richness, the passion, the issues that come out. We can, you know, a reader can follow the narrative and be very excited by that, whereas a poet has to win it word against word against word. Mm-hmm. You know, for language, that's where, that's the top of the mountain. So I have tremendous admiration for the poets and love of that. I read a lot of poetry. And in my own work, you know, I could always tell a story. I was always good with character. But language, you know, came last. And learning that, oh, yeah, it's not enough just to tell a good story. You know, it's got to be beautiful word by word. It has to be beautiful sentence by sentence. So the reader wants to gallop ahead to find out what happens, but also wants to linger to just read the sentence again. And that's my ideal. So to write, you know, I thought because she's a poet, it makes sense to write, you know, that she would write her story in verse. The reason that it's in prose is my own failure to be able to sustain. I wrote 17 chapters in verse and then got to a scene that I just could not do it in verse. I needed all my tools as a prose writer to understand what happened between people, between the characters, and then I was writing in prose and had to go back and take all those verse chapters into prose. And that's why the book is so big. It was never intended to be that. But, you know, you have to tell the story, you know, in a way that will move people. And the reader doesn't care how long it took you.
Yeah.
The reader just wants the rich experience.
Yeah. So then, you know, your sentences are so wonderful and your use of language, and yet you say that it was story really that came first and you had to learn to write that way. And do you spend just a ton of time revising or at this point, does it just come out wonderful? I mean,
no.
What about
no,
that?
It takes time. You know, I rewrite what I wrote the day before when I start work for the day. I go through what I wrote the day before or go back like 2 or 3 days and do some more, you know, tightening and, you know, making something, reading it aloud, getting more of a cadence, substituting a more interesting word. I'm very conscious of the sounds of or the feel of words in my mouth. You know, is it crunchy? Like, you know, is it crunchy or is it kind of bland and oatmeal-y? If it doesn't feel good in the mouth, it still needs, you know, it still needs work.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Janet Fitch. Her book is The Revolution of Marina M., published by Back Bay Books. So at the novel's beginning, Marina has quite a lovely life. Early on, she brings up class, and life goes awry. She leaves home. And I was thinking about your other novels and how class, the theme of class, seems to permeate all of them. And I wondered if that was a conscious choice or if that's just something that just comes out in the writing and you're surprised by it as well.
Well, class is one of the great, you know, social constants. And in America, we try not to talk about it. I think that Americans are so trained to be aspirational, to everybody, you know, thinks of themselves as potentially rich people. You know, the identification with class in Europe is really different. You know, so there is a sense, of, you know, yeah, I am a working class person and I embrace that, and there's nobility to it and there are traditions to it, and you know, we're not less than, you know, we are. Whereas in America, that's all so difficult for people to embrace, you know, because you're always supposed to be aspiring to you know, up the next rung of the ladder. And class is, you know, it's the bedrock. I mean, as an historian, you certainly, you know, are looking at large economic forces that create our world. And I think I grew up, my father's family was, they were probably pretty poor. It was, you know, they had a little grocery store in a small town in Iowa. But they didn't think much about it. It was a big family, and nobody had a sense that other people had more than they did. They just were very tight. My mother grew up extremely poor here in Los Angeles, and it was like a boom and bust situation with an alcoholic father. Mm-hmm. And she was in politics. She was, and she was always very, very aware of what people, you know, how people struggled. And what, as a poor girl who wanted to be, you know, find her way into society without much help, she became very aware of the difference, you know, and what she needed to know and what she didn't know, and very compassionate. My grandmother as well, she had my mother at 15, and she went back to school as a, you know, at 40, got her GED and got her BA and got her master's, and she became a reading specialist. And her thing was helping, she worked in continuation school, helping, you know, dropouts get their GED, and working with people who had trouble reading and thinking about their situation. And it's like, if you could only read 200 words, if you're only capable of reading 200 words, what should those 200 words be? What would help them? You know, she taught them how to read, you know, danger and poison and all that, but also to find their favorite food on a menu so they wouldn't be embarrassed on a date. You know, so I get it from, there's a line there of, you know, concern and class awareness, and you know, people don't think enough about, you know, what it is to really subsist on your own, your own labor, your own work, what's involved in living a dignified life.
It's interesting. There's been a lot of talk about Marina, your main character, and I'm also interested in your side characters and the part that side characters play. And so as I'm reading, I'm wondering, you know, where did Genya come from? Where did Kolya come from? What about Arkady? Where did these guys come from?
everybody in your writing is, you know, they're pieces of people you know or knew, and pieces of yourself. So there are these guys that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. The first two, her big love interests, Marina's big love interests, who are, you know, pieces of people I know, but also deal with issues that are on my mind, and they come to represent certain aspects and problems of human life, you know, people who have affected me in certain ways and issues that kind of stick to that. So these men are very much, you know, amalgams.
Mm-hmm.
And her two friends, the three girls that begin the book, each is affected by the revolution in a different way, and they keep changing places within that society. So you have a radical Varvara, who is very much a part of the revolution, and she advances in that society very quickly because she's both extremely radical and very well educated and of steely character. She's a very angry girl, and she just finds herself in the revolution. It suits her perfectly, and she advances very quickly and becomes a person of some authority. Then there's the scientist who ends up being a photographer because her family needs her support. And she starts out as kind of the naivest of them and the most timid, and becomes a very different person. And then Marina is sort of the spoiled daddy's girl. She's pretty and passionate and, you know, kind of wild, but she's very much supported by her class and her family. But she takes her idealism, her passion for, you know, the lives of common people and trying to improve their lives, and it during the revolution that tears her family apart. So she ends up, you know, living the life of the revolution, which she has embraced, but then she has to live it, and nothing has prepared her for that.
Yeah, but, you know, as you're talking about these different characters and there's all these different things going on, how do you keep track? Do you have, like, butcher paper that lines your office with timelines and character, you know, biographies and plots and subplots? I mean, how is it all in your head? What are you doing?
It is all in my head. It is something that I do naturally. You know, I'm a people person. If I meet people, you know, and hear their stories, I always see them and their story together. My husband is always amazed that I can, you know, go into a party of people I know and know each person's backstory and how they know that person. And that's part of my nature. I'm kind of a social being. But I I use something called Scrivener, where it's
sure.
very easy to toggle back and forth between your research and your, what you're actively writing.
Hmm.
So I do have, you know, people's, like, when they were born, where they're from, But I see them as living three-dimensional people. I don't have as much problem keeping them apart, keeping track of the storyline. Yes, so I do have, I do have timelines. Because the thing about writing historically is that it's not only what happens to your characters, but things are happening in the exterior world that is absolutely affecting everyone in wartime, in revolution. You know, the exterior world will affect what happens on the social level in a very serious way. So I have to keep track of what happened in this week of, you know, August 1918, because it changes the whole story.
Well, a few minutes ago, we were talking about side characters, and you know, you said they're amalgams of people you've known, or you know, various things. And so, I'm thinking of one of your Writing Wednesdays, in which you talked about how you're a fiction writer. Through and through, that you transmute some of what you've experienced through your fiction, whereas, you know, memoirists are kind of taking what it is and putting it down, and there should be no fictionalizing. So will you talk a little bit about that? Was there ever a question of whether you would be a memoirist or a fiction writer, or was it fiction from the very start?
It was fiction from the very start. I am an extremely secretive, I mean, it's funny, it's like I'm kind of, in certain ways, probably the most, you know, I mean, I'll tell you anything. I'm pretty open that way, but there are things that I would never, ever, ever write about, because it's kind of like the source material for everything I'm ever going to write. So I can't see, you know, writing it up as, you know, writing things up as the way they actually happened, you know, kind of burns the material that I wouldn't be able to use it in fiction. And why would I want to burn my source to, you know, that I could get, you know, a dozen books out of in a single sweep? And also, it's not that interesting, and people would go, oh, like, that's it. Whereas in fiction, I use those paints and can bring elements together that didn't actually come together in my own story, my own personal story. But thematically, the things I'm interested in, the things that obsess me, I don't even do it consciously. They come together. Things meet that did not actually meet in my life, but certainly meet in my psyche. So every novel, every piece of fiction is actually in some way deeply autobiographical, but not in the way the reader thinks, which is usually they think that the surface events are the autobiographical element, whereas in fact it's the obsession, it's the concern, the worry, the thematic element is what's autobiographical. And usually the events are not.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And your Writing Wednesdays are just wonderful. Talk about starting them. Why did you start these?
Oh, I love doing the Writing Wednesdays on my Facebook author page.
That's great.
They were, I was... When the book came out, it was suggested to me that I could do a video on my author page. And it's just propping your phone up and having a subject and talking about it, you know, for 10 minutes, 15, and putting it out there. It's so easy. And I find, like, if I drop my if I drop my phone or something funny happens, the sirens come by, the garbage truck or whatever, people just think it's funny because it's it's do-it-yourself. Nobody is holding me to a very high standard. So it's so relaxed that I just can talk about whatever's on my mind. And I have taught for many, many years. I've taught at graduate level. I've taught undergrads. I've taught you know, junior high. I've taught. I love to teach. And I'm not teaching right now. And, like, what if I was hit by a truck, you know? I mean, isn't it better to have this information out in the world? You know, why hoard it? So instead of waiting for my next university appointment, you know, I just thought, oh, well, let's, people are always writing to me and asking me about these, you know, having their concerns. All writers have the same concerns, really. And I thought, well, this would be a fun thing to do. So, you know, anything you, for me, I'm a creature of habit. So if I started doing these, a Writing Wednesday, every Wednesday I'll wake up and go, oh, it's Writing Wednesday. What should I talk about? And sometimes I have a topic, and sometimes I just look at the questions that have come in and make, you know, if three of them are about endings and beginnings, then, you know, clearly I have a theme going.
Yeah.
I just love doing it.
Yeah, I love them. And I think I'm down one. I have to watch one. But what's your theme today? Do you have a theme, or do you
My
wait till questions come in?
My theme is savagery. That I think that where a lot of writers seem to fall down, a lot of things that I'm seeing is that everybody's so nice these days, and people have done their therapy, and they're spiritually in a good, you know, I mean, not necessarily in a good place, but spiritually they're trying to be fair and generous and really give everyone their due. And this is what we aspire to as human beings, you know, to be evolved people. But on the page, when you're writing, you know, you got to put that nice thing aside, like Mr. Rogers taking off his jacket. But instead of putting on a cardigan, you know, you just get rid of that niceness and all the training and all the therapy and really, you know, let the savage person emerge with all their rawness and their woundedness and, you know, everything that's really, you know, been a very strong influence, a strong emotion, something that's deep inside that's still there. You can't therapize that out. You can, what you therapize, when you're in therapy, you know, you learn not to act on that part of your personality, but you never eradicate it. You know, it's always there. And it's probably the vital spring of your creative self is that savage self. So I don't say you should be savage and make your children cry and piss off all your friends and stuff. You know, I'm a very much of a believer in being evolved spiritually and stuff like that. But you never lose track of that white hot or red hot stuff that is deep in the core of your, you know, of your earth. You know, just like the earth has this great molten core, you know, you got to go down into the mines where it's hot and dirty and dangerous, and that's where the fiction comes from. That's where the art comes from. And if you lose touch with that hot, nasty, scary, dangerous, dark, sweaty place, you know, your stuff is going to be like eating, you know, white bread and homogenized milk, and it's just not going to move anyone or heat anything up or disturb, you know, do I dare disturb the universe? Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you don't have that savagery, you can write a really nice book, and it can be very nice, and everybody's very nice and stuff, but you can't really create art that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of which, and we have a ton more to talk about, but whatever we don't get to today, we'll get to in January when you come down to Newport. But there's a scene in, it's pretty much the center of the book where Marina is held captive by Arcady.
Yeah.
And that scene is so raw and difficult. And as I was reading it, I was wondering how it was for you to write it and what it did to you or took out of you to do that. And I don't want to really give the scene away unless you want to, but is that kind of what you're talking about?
It's the ability to look the tough stuff in the face. What is, you know, from the writer's point of view, it's not so much, you know, can I write a scene where my character gets hurt or where somebody is hurt, where somebody is really challenged, because I'm kind of a savage person. And I feel like, you know, if it happens in life, you should be able to write about it. And she is a very passionate person, in touch with her own savagery. So when she is in a difficult situation, she's not like, oh, why me, why me? Well, maybe a little bit. But she's more like, what am I going to do? How am I going to, you know, how am I going to get through this? How am I going to live through this? You know, and being, you know, she's willing to go all the way. I mean, she's willing to fight for her life. She's not going to roll over. She's not that kind of a person. So for me, it's this weird relationship, you know, between the two of them. That yes, he is a very dangerous person, and she's still kind of naive. She thinks she knows what she's dealing with, and then she sees what she's dealing with. And it, you know, we don't become worldly people by reading a book, you know. I mean, we do actually learn about life from reading and from everything else. But, you know, you become a worldly person by making terrible mistakes and then having to deal with it. And then from ever after, you are more aware of what the world is made of.
Hmm. And you said something, maybe on your website, there's a piece called 10 Tips for Writers or something. And it may be in that you say, they're your characters, not your kids.
Right. I think that people, when they're, And this makes, you know, I mean, I've certainly been there. I mean, I've been in through any all of this. That's why I can teach it. Is that we love our characters. We don't want anything to happen to them, you know. So there's a lot of pulled punches in bad writing, where somebody almost gets a big boo boo, but you know, in the last minute, something saves them. I don't like that. I mean, I want to see the blow land.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I really hate books with pulled punches, you know, that the character almost, something bad almost happens to the character. You know, it's like, no, you know, that blow must land. And I want to feel it land.
Mm.
And then it's real. And then it's sharp. And then it's dangerous. And then it's, you know, then there's some risk on the page and the reader can, you know, there's no cozy little, there's no Vaseline on the lens. It's not a cozy, you know, where we're lying on a bark of loungers and stuff. I just don't care about that.
That's great. And we have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about point of view, and we'll have to talk more about this in January, but what a big book for one point of view. Was there ever a decision to do multiple points of view?
Yeah, there was. I had each of the girls had their own point of view. But it was just, Marina was so much more compelling. Mm-hmm. Because she was a poet, and I like characters who, a certain kind of character who is, I call it like the binocular effect. You know, a person with a foot in two worlds makes a really good protagonist, because they can see a problem, an issue, from two points of view. Now, Marina is somebody who grew up in a very affluent, educated, her mother's minor aristocracy. So she she comes from that world of the high bourgeoisie, but she her affinities are for the, you know, are for the working class and are for the people who struggle and are for the, you know, she has such a feeling for injustice in the world. And when she starts living the life of the revolution, which is very difficult, you know, very, you know, it was difficult just to get, you know, to heat tiny stoves that vented out the window, just to find the wood. You know, all the plumbing broke in the buildings because there were no landlords, mm-hmm. and there was no heat, and, you know, the pipes broke, and people are pumping water in these huge apartment houses. They're pumping water in the, you know, in the courtyard in winter in Russia, you know. Her life is very difficult. So the fact that she both believes in the revolution, but she also can see the point of view of the former people, you know, who have been declassed by revolution, who've lost their fortunes and are selling spoons on the street. And she can see from both points of view, gives her a unique perspective and really is very helpful as a writer to when people are aware of the contradictions both around them and within them. That makes for, you know, the best of all protagonists.
Mm. Well, there's so much more to talk about, and we're just going to have to do it in January. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Janet, and look forward to your Writing Wednesday today on your Facebook page.
Oh, and, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you.
It has been really fun, and look forward to seeing you in January.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. That was Janet Fitch. Her new book is The Revolution of Marina M., published by Back Bay, which is, let's see, it's an imprint of something, Little Brown and Company. And yeah, so much more to talk about. She'll be down in Newport in January, I think January 15th. It's a Tuesday night at the Pen on Fire speaker series. You can find out more at penonfire.com. And do check out her Writing Wednesdays on Facebook every Wednesday at noon. And if you can't get there at noon, you can tune in later, visit that page later and watch it. That's all for now. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you've been listening to Writers on Writing. We're here every Wednesday at 9 a.m. We are on iTunes, Writers on Writing, many, many podcasts to listen to, all free. And if you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a little review. That'll help other listeners find us. Thank you so much. And it's the holidays, difficult time to write, but get in a few minutes every day. You'll be glad you did. Thanks for listening.